For a lot of years, I was involved with music here and our worship team. And I was thinking about all that process. And musicians, by and large, sometimes aren't always the easiest people to work with. Because we have egos and whatever. But I was thinking this morning while everybody was singing and leading us in worship this morning. I can remember hearing in our first whatever years a lot the comment, man, you guys have so many gifted musicians and singers there. And I remember us going, yeah, well, that's true. We really do. And that's true now, but I don't hear that so much anymore. I see a body that knows more about worshiping now, I think, than we've ever known before, worshiping together. And I just really appreciate the fact that our music leaders are worshipers, you know, that they worship. And that just is so helpful to me, so helpful to my heart. So thank you guys for doing that, for all of you. I think it's cool how you interchange and are able to adapt to one another. Although I still think they should let me play drums, but it hasn't happened. Okay, so this is, I want to do a little bit of a transition between 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. It was really an emotional week for me looking at 2 Corinthians, because I kind of got caught up in, it had to be hard to be Paul, you know, it just had to be difficult. And I can't even begin to compare my life to Paul's life, because when I look down the list of what he experienced, I truly have first world problems. But as I got caught up in that and I thought about not so much what was done or not done to Paul, but what did it feel like inside to experience what he experienced with the Corinthians? You know, it wasn't just the Corinthians. He experienced it kind of everywhere he went, in all the cities in which he went. So I thought, as I was looking at 2 Corinthians, how much he wove in what he started out with in 1 Corinthians, where he talked about the two paths of wisdom, the two wisdoms, and how when we choose the path of the wisdom of God, our life is not going to look anything like our neighbors who choose often the path of the wisdom of men, okay? And it was really woven all the way through 2 Corinthians. So as we continue to read that, just kind of look for that and look for that whole idea about how Paul was seeing that wisdom being worked out. There were a few highlights in 1 Corinthians that I thought summarized choosing the wisdom of God really well. And you probably have some and you shared some last week. But I'd like to look at a couple as we transition over into 2 Corinthians. Chapter 3, verse 21. This is so much a part of the wisdom of God. So then, let no one boast in man. I mean, think about what a big statement that is, because we have so many ways of boasting in man. You know, some trust in chariots, some trust in horses. But as for me, I will trust in the Lord God. But we have so many ways of boasting in man. Look at me. Look at us. Look what mankind is able to do. I mean, even God, after the tower was built, what did they say to each other in the Trinity and with the angels? He said, if they did this, what is it? What's beyond man? Man can do almost anything. So then, let no one boast in man, for all things belong to you. And we talked about this briefly. So get this, okay? Don't boast in man. That's that road. This road is all things belonging to you. So you and I are on the road of our inheritance already. We are already heirs. We are already on the road, because when we choose the wisdom of God, we are on the road of a son or of a daughter. That's a totally different way in looking at life. And a lot of times from this road over here, people are wrestling with spiritual issues and looking at their heart and trying to figure out what's going on inside of them, but they're not on this road. So when you and I live on this road as knowing who we are, We're surrounded by people who don't know who they are. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, everything belongs to you because you are an heir of the Most High God. And you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. I think about all of the different identity statements that are made throughout the scriptures about who we are and what that means. I don't know how to put it any more succinctly than that. You know, don't boast in men. Everything belongs to you. And you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. So from that, in my psyche, in my heart, I think, I can't allow myself to forget who I am, who I really am. I know who I am as a human being. I know what my shortcomings are. I know what my difficulties are. But I can't lose the sight of my identity. Another thing that struck out to me as I was going into 2 Corinthians is 1 Corinthians 9. And there are lots of ways to run. I mean, if you've ever been in a race, you can, if you watch me run in a race, which I've run in a few, you'd go, well, that's not the way to run a race when you watch me. Do you not know, verse 24, chapter 9, that those who run in a race, everybody runs. Okay, so think about these two paths. Okay, everybody's running. Everybody's going down the path, some at different speeds, some with different abilities. We are on the path of being heirs of Christ. Humanity is on both paths, depending upon where their hearts are. Run in such a way so that you may be victorious. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control. And I can't, this is a hard one, because when you talk about self-control, it sounds like, well, these are things I need to make myself do. Well, that is a part of what self-control is, but what is the motivation for being self-controlled? I want to be self-controlled so that I can win. Why do I want to win? Because I want to receive the crown that comes from a race well run. And what do I want to do with that crown? I want to cast it down to the glory of God the Father. And I want to do my part in saying, this is not my crown. This is your crown. They do it to receive this perishable wreath. A perishable wreath, you know, you kind of think of the Roman idea, which I think is what's being described here, which I think really was making room for balding people. I was looking in the mirror the other day and thinking about the Greek word here. But that's a perishable wreath. You can see that wreath. You know, it's like a trophy that you can put, up on your fireplace, and they can say, oh, where did you get that wreath? Well, I won that in Athens just the other day, or 5 years ago, or whatever. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we do it to receive an imperishable one. So this wreath that we are running so that we can win is to not just win the race, but it's to get an imperishable wreath that can go to the glory of God. Therefore, so I run in such a way, not without aim. I box in such a way, not as beating the air. I'm not a shadow boxer. What good does it do to, you know, be involved in a contest and, you know, be in a race and go the wrong direction? I mean, what good does that do? Not beating the air, but I discipline my body. And I think it's talking about the whole part of who we are as people. Because who we are as a people wants the recognition of men. So I have to discipline myself to not want the recognition of men, but to want the acknowledgement of God and the reward of God. So that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. So in this wisdom of God, I see an identity issue. In this wisdom of God, I see a discipline issue. Not just for the sake of discipline, but for making sure that when I get to the end of that race, I'm going to receive the imperishable crown. And so that means that what I accomplish at work, what I accomplish at church, what I accomplish in my neighborhood, what I accomplish in my 401k, all of those different things, those are all secondary to that imperishable wreath that I'm going to receive. Now, this is one that I almost took a little bit more time to talk about, chapter 8, and it's kind of divided out into two conversations. It's talking about people who are weak in conscience and people who are strong in conscience. So I'm still wrestling with this. I was talking at an elders meeting with Dave Kester of Romans 15 is a good passage that goes with this passage. But there's the idea of having a strong conscience, and there's the idea of having a weak conscience. For me personally, I have a strong conscience in some areas. I have a weak conscience in other areas. That's just what it's like to be human. And in this book, basically what Paul is saying, and I don't have time to read the passages now, but this is a big deal. If you can capture this, if you can get a hold of this idea that everybody's conscience is different, and each man's conscience is how he or she will stand before God, that's a huge deal. And so I might run into somebody who has a weak conscience in a place that I have a strong conscience, or vice versa. They have a strong conscience where I have a weak conscience. And what Paul is arguing for here is that the wisdom of God will say, don't get hung up on those issues. Do not set aside love for one another because of issues of conscience. Does that mean we don't speak the truth in love to one another? Of course not. Of course not. Does that mean that we don't gently encourage and correct one another or whatever? I mean, there's so many different aspects to that. Well, of course not. But it's not about the issue of being recognized by men. So if you can become a person who is a champion of conscience, now this is tough because I'm not just talking about, well, I'm okay with what I do, and you're okay with what you do, and I'm going to make room for that. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the war that happens inside of every person as they try to live with a clear conscience, and it's a very difficult thing to do. And we are supposed to be allies to each other in living with a clear conscience before God. So if you read these passages, sometimes you come along with a strong conscience and encourage somebody who has a weak conscience. Sometimes you come along with a weak conscience and you appeal to someone with a stronger conscience. There's so many different dimensions to it. But that's part of the wisdom of God. And the reason I'm spending a little bit of time on it right now is because I think it's like ready-made for the times that we're living in. This is so key that we be ambassadors for Christ, that we represent Christ in this whole area of conscience, and that we're constantly championing the idea of a clear conscience before God. Not a clear conscience before me, not a clear conscience before men, but a clear conscience before God. It's huge. Also, this wisdom of God, and so never forget who you are, so it's an identity, running to win because of the whole wreath, the crown, championing of conscience as you live out your walk. We're also supposed to reject craving. Chapter 10, verse 6, and he's going back and talking about Israel, which we talked about a little bit. Now, these things happened as examples for us so that we would not crave evil things. So is it easy to be on the road of an inheritance of a son or a daughter and live a life of craving? Live a life of satiating what it is that we want in our flesh that draws us? Is that even a reasonable thing to do? Well, no. Number one, it's not going to work very well. And number two, how honoring is it to the one who has saved us and given us all things? How honoring is it for him if I allow myself to crave evil things? And the word there is interesting because it just basically means I can't be satisfied. I can't be satisfied with what's on this road over here. I have to pull from the wisdom of the world in order to get the satisfaction that I want. So championing conscience, rejecting craving. This is kind of tied into the conscience thing in chapter 11, verse 19, submission over factions. For there must also be factions or divisions or recognizable sects or whatever you want to call it. For there must be factions among you so that those who are approved may become evident to you. It's the worst thing in the world when I hang around with people who are supposed to be spiritual and you realize you're in a conversation where it's about people being recognized. It's just absolutely, and I'm not just talking about other people, I'm talking about myself. You know, I'll be in a situation and I'll go, wait, you know, how come people don't see me the way that I'd like to be seen? You know, it's insidious inside the human condition. And what does that do? Then that causes factions. You know, this is me, this is you, I've got this, you've got this. Mine is here, yours is here. Isn't that how humans live? Not just externally, but isn't that what's going on inside? I heard a quote once that said, 75% of people feel that they're above average. And I thought, you know, that's really true. Maybe 90%. And right along with that, then, over in verse 28, but a man must examine himself. And I was thinking about this while Ray was talking and while we were celebrating communion. I mean, this this passage is like, whoa, when it comes to sharing in the Lord's Supper. This is the whoa part of it. But I want to extract that here in the context of factions. But a man must examine himself. And in so doing, he is to eat of the bread and drink of the cup, like we just did. He must examine himself. He must look inside. And he must look for where the wisdom of God is being displayed in his life and where the wisdom of man is. And that's what a part of communion is supposed to be. We're actually supposed to come to communion, and of course, there's the loving, great part of the fact that all things belong to me. But there's also the nasty part of the fact that even though all things belong to me, I still live in so many ways like I'm on the other road. So submitting to one another in the midst of our nature to have factions between us, the only way to disarm us or disarm this is to be with a group of people who don't want to end up on top. Because they know that all things belong to them. So that's so practical. Our identity is so practical. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous in doing what is good? Peter. I could start quoting passages right now that talk about this paradox. So the wisdom of God is identity. The wisdom of God is running in the right way. It's championing conscience, rejecting craving, submission to God over factions, because it's the only way that we escape it. And then there's the whole issue of spiritual gifts. And this is really a conundrum, because the Corinthians appear to be incredibly gifted. They appear to have all gifts, and they appear to be functioning, but they don't seem to be being used for this part over here. They're being used for the wisdom of man, and that's why there are factions between them. Chapter 12, verse 1, now concerning your spiritual gifts, and I want you to think about your spiritual gifts. We probably need to return to this soon and just talk about it, because our body is maturing, and with a lot of the younger people that I have conversations with, I ask them, yeah, what do you know about your spiritual gifts? I don't know. I don't really know. Am I supposed to even know? Are there even spiritual gifts? Whatever. There are a lot of questions about it. Now, concerning spiritual gifts, brothers, I don't want you to be unaware. You know that when you were pagans, when you were on that road, you were led astray to mute idols, however you were led. Therefore, I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God says Jesus is accursed, and no one can say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. That's a demarcation there. That's a differentiation. Now, there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. Now, think about the different gifts that are just in this room right here. And multiply that by millions. Varieties of gifts. But not only varieties of gifts, verse 6, there are varieties of effects. So I may have the gift of teaching, for example, but the gift of teaching might be expressed in 1,000 ways. Okay? So there are varieties of gifts, but there are also varieties of effects. But the same God who works all things in all persons. And that's what Paul's calling for, is he's calling for the unity that we're supposed to be experiencing as we use our gifts in loving one another. I'm not sure when I see some of the conflict that I see that it's based on people using their gifts. I wonder. But to each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge according to the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by one Spirit, to another the effecting of miracles, to another prophecy, to another the distinguishing of spirits, to another various kinds of tongues, to another the interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually just as he wills. Now this conversation about gifts is woven through a number of chapters in Corinthians. It actually goes all the way back through to the beginning of I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, and I am of Christ. But I'd like you to turn over to 14:1. And I'm skipping over the love chapter, right? So the love chapter is like right in the middle of this conversation, this comprehensive conversation about gifts. Pursue love, because love is the best, right? If you can love somebody, isn't that the best that you can do? No, it's not. Pursue love, the greatest of these is love, yet earnestly desire spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. Why do I want that to happen? Because I love better when I use my gifts to love other people. So Paul is drawing them into a conversation. They know they're gifted. They're just using their gifts to exalt themselves. So earnestly using our gifts in love. And then as he launches us into 2 Corinthians chapter 15, I mean, what a wonderful, I can't hardly leave this chapter in Corinthians whenever I go there, but we'll do it. Chapter 15, verse 19. So in all of these things that I've just described, don't they take some kind of commitment? Don't they take some kind of determination to never forget who I am, to run to win, to champion conscience, to reject craving, submission over faction, earnestly desiring your gifts in love? You know, people on the right road, they don't even think about this stuff. And a lot of people who are on the other road, the identity road, they don't think about it either because of the nature of humanity and the nature of our culture. If we have hoped, if you have chosen to do these things, if you have given your life to set yourself aside and to live this way, as well as the other things that are mentioned in Corinthians and in the letters and in the Gospels, if we have hoped in Christ in this life only, we are of all men to be most pitied. And you know, I can't read 2 Corinthians and go without going, Paul must have believed this to the core. The core of who he was. If this has only happened, if I have only made the determinations that I have made for this life, I am of all men to be most pitied. Because I have an inheritance. I have a life to come. I have a reward that I'm sharing in. And flip on down to verse 58, long chapter. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast. So even in the middle of this nasty situation with the Corinthians, Paul never loses his hope for the Corinthians, which in and of itself is just a wonderful gift to anybody who tries to do the will of God, right? Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. You know, I find myself saying to myself now, I go, sometimes I just feel like quitting. You know, I just feel like I just want to stop. I've been doing the same thing now for 45 years of my life, and I just want to stop. And I wallow in that for a moment, and then God basically tells me, you're not going to stop until I am finished with you. That's when you're going to stop. And basically, he's told me, I'm going to stop you. So you don't have to think about it. Always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your work, that your toil in the Lord is not in vain. So he takes all of these messages from 1 Corinthians and explains that to the people at Corinth. And this is what I came up with.
Like a warm breeze on a cold night is the breath of the one who loves upon my soul. Like firelight on a cold night are the words of a friend along the lonesome road. It can free me when I'm weary and break my heart of stone. Put a thousand friends around me. Can take me to the mountaintop, make my heart with joy to stop, gaze into the eyes of firelight.
So that's the launch into 2 Corinthians. And 2 Corinthians, as I said, is kind of tough. And that's why I wrote Paul's tough struggle on there, because his struggle is coming out as he continues to be faithful to the Corinthians and to hope for more and to expect more. And I see kids at the window now. I was going to spend a little bit more time on this. But defending his true ministry, why Paul had to do that is explained by the two wisdoms. Expressing a desire for giving, which it did relate to financial giving, but it wasn't only financial giving. He was talking about seed to the sower, you know? He wanted us to have plenty of seed, time, talents, and treasures. And then we are destroying speculations and lofty things that raise themselves up against the knowledge of God. So that's the warfare part of it, as he speaks Christ in the sight of God. So we'll head into that. If you've started in 2 Corinthians, you're a leg up. And for next week, we'll begin with you articulating an observation that you have out of 2 Corinthians, a question that you may have, a personal revelation that you experienced. I expressed several of those to you as I was just teaching, several personal revelations that happened to me over the last week or two. And right along with that, something that moves you.